Herodotus called his book The Histories, but that name doesn't really do it justice. It's a work of great literature, full of fascinating travelogues, astute cultural commentary, fast-paced action, and biblical-style tales of redemptions and retributions. 2,500 years after he wrote it, Herodotus' story of a great power defeated by a motley alliance of Greek city-states continues to have resonance, and his account of the failed Persian campaign is still a fabulous read. Robert Strassler's book, The Landmark Herodotus, is published by Pantheon Books, and I'm very pleased it has brought him to the show. Welcome.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Now, you worked on The Landmark Herodotus for more than 10 years. Why did it take so much longer than The Landmark Thucydides?
Well, it's very easy to explain. Thucydides limits himself to military and political history. There are no racy stories. There are no interesting anecdotes. There are no anthropological studies. He's just a beef and potatoes historian on military and political history. Herodotus is interested in what people wear, in what people what crops they grow, their food, their gods, their worship. Everything that that people do interests him. He has an absolutely omnivorous curiosity, and everything fits into his concept of history and what you need to know in order to understand what happened. So I needed to consult anthropologists. I needed to find somebody who knew about the Black Sea early cultures. I needed to know somebody about Egypt and Herodotus in Egypt, much more complicated than Thucydides.
And then you wrote annotations on it all to make it comprehensible to the modern reader?
Well,
because this was really written for Herodotus's contemporaries.
Herodotus wrote it for his own contemporaries. And, of course, how could he imagine how much the world would change in 2,500 years? Or that he'd be around. His book would be around for 2,500 years. So he didn't bother to explain a lot of things that to a Greek reader of the 5th century BC were ordinary and common and well understood. But to American or to a modern reader of the 21st century, there's no experience that they can bring to it. It's all a mystery.
Now, Herodotus is said to have invented history as a genre, but what do you think he should be credited with? Because I mean, some of this history is rather dubious, isn't it?
Some of it is, but, you know, he covers himself very well. He'll say, I heard this, or I was told, and so I'm passing it on. Or he'll even say, I don't believe this, but, you know, it's interesting, so I'm passing it on. You can make up your own mind.
Well, he describes a hippopotamus, for example.
Right.
We know he gets some things really wrong.
He got that from somebody else, obviously, and that somebody else we think we know, but that person was quite wrong, and he had no way to check it. There's some theory that, you know, he didn't really go to some of the places he said he did, that he went down to Piraeus and sat in the bars and talked to ship captains and travelers and got a lot of information that way. And it's clear he was a very personable fellow in a way that Thucydides might not have been. People liked to talk to him, and he got all kinds of people to say all kinds of things. And I think in some cases it's unlikely he believed them, but he passed them on anyway because he thought they were cute or funny or good yarns. And so we have that in the book.
If he invented it, what did the Greek word that's translated histories mean before he used it as
Historia really means and still meant in Greece and up to the many, many centuries after him, investigations, research. And so when he says his opening words are, I, Herodotus from Halicarnassus, present here the results of my research, he's really talking about investigations that he conducted mostly by voice, because you didn't have libraries, you didn't have documents to go read. And so he did it by talking to people.
How soon, long after the Greek and Persian War, was he researching and writing about these events?
We think he was born somewhere around 480 when the war started. And therefore, he was able to talk to many people 30 years later who participated in it, who knew about it very well, who were already covering their tracks to say things differently and make themselves look better. But he was a pretty savvy fellow. He certainly was in close contact with the people of the war. And there's some indication that some people think that as he wrote about the tyrant Xerxes in later in life, he was really talking a little bit about warning Athens, which was conducting itself in a tyrannical fashion.
Because the Peloponnesian Wars were going on at the time.
Were beginning, and Athens conducted itself in such a way before the war as to get the ire and the dismay of most other Greeks. And it's as if he's presenting a foil to them to look at. Just look what happened to Xerxes, overwhelming pride, hubris, and destruction, which, of course, he was right.
So this is not just history, it's also a cautionary tale, which often modern histories are
very
intended
much
to be
so.
As well.
History has always been thought to be didactic in its basic content. I like to think it's a good story, and you draw out of it what you can, and sometimes it is very didactic. Not always, though.
He promises to be fair in reporting the magnificent deeds of the barbarians as well as of the Greeks. So how objective did he turn out to be?
Well, he gave the Persians their due. He clearly has a lot of respect for the Scythians and the Egyptians. In fact, he's amazed.
He spends a lot of time writing about them, even though they really have nothing to do with the story.
Very little to do with it, yes. But these are sort of travelogues, and it's part of the buildup of making the epic ending so powerful is that you spent all this time to get there. You followed the Persians around as they conquered the Egyptians, and you followed them as they conquered the Babylonians. And every time they conquer somebody, he talks about them and the Lydians, and here they come against the Greeks. And, of course, they fail there. They're repulsed.
Well, he starts off the story with descriptions of multiple abductions of women, including Helen of Troy. And I was wondering whether Homer was perhaps a model.
Homer's definitely a model, but I'll come back to that in a minute. It's clear that that's a joke. He wants to make light of these silly theories of history that it was because the Eastern people absconded with a few women and then the Greeks came back and took it. It's a joke. And he ends that section very early in the book and says, but I know who the first person who really injured the Greeks was. And his name was Croesus. And he was a Lydian. And it's only 100 years earlier. So he's in a range of history where it's real. Now, talking about Homer is very interesting. Homer has had a big impact on him. There's no doubt about it. Homer, for example, in order to poetically have his heroes be fine, has to have their opponents be fine. And so there is a real respect for the Trojans and a real respect, let's say, for Hector, the champion, as opposed to Achilles, who's a crazy man. And you don't see Achilles in a human context at all. You see Hector as a family man. And that carries over to Thucydides and Herodotus, where they try to be balanced in their approach to both sides. If in Roman history or Latin history, it's always us Romans against all the rest, and they were worth nothing, and how we came to rule the world. And the concept of history is very much biased and ethnocentric.
And much more boring to read.
And in ways, yes.
But in Homer, the gods play a major role. Do they in Herodotus as well?
They do in Herodotus. He clearly, which they don't in Thucydides, he believed apparently that the gods were trying to tell us what was going to happen. He refers to oracles all the time and to the importance of treating the gods right and respecting them. And he would say, I could tell you about this. I know what happened here, but it would be blasphemous for me to do so, so I won't. Or he'll say, I know who did this, but I can't tell you. And he wants to be straight with the gods. And yet he describes several incidents, for example, in which the most important oracle, the Delphic oracle, is bribed and does something political on behalf of some people who are paying the oracle. And so he also is planting seeds of doubt, if I were a Greek reader, that you can't be sure if it's a big – if you're going to ask her, what do I do to cure the measles, you probably nobody's going to pay to have or give you a false answer.
He also suggests that if the thing turns out the way the oracle predicted, then – obviously, everybody believed, and if it turns out differently, it's because they didn't really trust the oracles.
Well,
it
often
this is a lot of ex post facto thinking,
or they misunderstood what the god was really trying to tell. The god speaks in riddles, he meant that he's not always clear, and so you have to. And you're always the human beings don't think of the other or possible alternatives, and so when things don't work out the way they thought, it's not the god's fault.
We're talking about the landmark Herodotus, the Histories, edited by Robert B. Strassler, who is my guess, and there's a new translation by Andrea L. Purvis, and the book is published by Pantheon. You mentioned Croesus. Now, Croesus is the ultimate cautionary tale here. He is a man who loses his empire.
Right. He loses it because he attacks another empire under the impression that he gets an oracle that says the great empire will fall. And he naturally assumes, or stupidly assumes, that it's the other empire that will fall. And in fact, he loses his own.
And is the same sort of thing applicable to what happened with the Persians? I mean, is he suggesting that that's what happened, or is he suggesting the Greeks better watch out?
It's not quite a parallel. Xerxes is a tyrant. There are many anecdotes of Xerxes cutting off the heads of people randomly or in a fit of rage and doing terrible things to people. They come and ask him a favor, and he says, that's a terrible thing, and he has them killed. And he's telling you that because he thinks that the unbridled power of a tyrant is something to be avoided. And he really likes Greek government, whether it's democracy, and he seems to like democracy, or even just constitutional government where people have their place and their role and they obey the gods. He foils that against the Persian tyranny. And, you know, the Persian soldiers have to be driven into battle with whips, which is probably totally false. And the Greeks, on the other hand, fight for freedom and fight for themselves, and they're heroic. And he does set up those dichotomies that are, let's just say, fantastic or poetic. But he does not treat Xerxes as having the kind of hubris that necessarily brings on the nemesis of his defeat. And in fact, in some ways, he does achieve one goal. He takes Athens, he burns it to the ground, and then he goes back home. From his point of view, from Herodotus' point of view, they've been defeated, right? But from his point of view, it may not have been a very important defeat. He conquered so much, he vindicated his honor, and he had to go back home because a Persian emperor couldn't be far away from home for too long. There were too many members of the family close to the crown, and he had to be careful.
Herodotus says his goal is to make sure that the great and wonderful deeds not go unsung. And then he traces the causes of events back to the ambitions and actions of individuals. So is this the beginning of the great man approach to history?
Yes, you could say so. But, you know, Homer is also a great man.
I mean, but was Homer considered history, even though
no.
It turns out later when Schliemann follows Homer that it probably more history than people imagined it was?
The ancient Greeks certainly thought Homer was history. And Herodotus uses him as an authority. And so does Thucydides, who really cared about authorities. When they had nothing else to fall on, they would fall back on what Homer said and say, well, that proves this or indicates that or – makes it clear about what this meant. So, it's the great man theory of history, and that was a Greek conception right from the beginning. If you had told them about social masses and social currents
– and economics.
They would have nodded at you, but that wouldn't interest them. If Herodotus will take a battle that is obviously something that involves thousands of people, and he'll make it a titanic struggle between a few champions – and that's what Greeks liked and what they could understand. So.
It also fits in with the whole idea of hubris. You could fall because of that, and only a great man can.
You can ascribe hubris to somebody, but not necessarily to some nation or a group of people very easily.
And that is the human tragic flaw.
Yes.
Which is a basic theme here. I think probably the two basic themes are the rise and fall of empires and hubris, and they are linked together. Croesus actually becomes an advisor to Cyrus, and a wise advisor figure appears throughout the histories. Do they serve a similar purpose to the oracles?
Well, yes. He needs to have somebody discuss policy and affairs with Xerxes and Cyrus and Darius because otherwise, how else can he explain what Persian policy is all about or what's driving the Persians or what's making them do certain things? So, yes, he sets up these dialogues, which are clearly – I mean, he wasn't in the bedroom and he wasn't in the crown's chambers. So they're made up in order to explain various things, just as, let's say, Thucydides will copy a speech down or give a speech in there, but he wasn't there. And he says, well, in that case, I just write down what I think the speakers were called upon to say what the situation demanded.
And he tells the story of Darius as another cautionary tale because that has to do with Persian politics.
Very much so.
Some of these things, for example, we don't have a lot of time. The story of Astyages and Cyrus will remind readers of the Oedipus story. So because Or maybe infanticide was a common act with the baby saved only if he's given to shepherds for safekeeping. This is another example where you say, wait a minute, an alarm bell just went off.
That's a story that appears in so many cultures and so many myths in so many places of a father or grandfather getting a prediction that the son or grandson is going to overthrow him and do terrible things. So he attempts to get the child killed, and they send them off into the woods, but the child is miraculously suckled by a wolf or picked up by a peasant lady, or something happens so the child comes back to get him.
Now, we do have a lot of real history here, and we learn a lot about Sparta and how its double king system works and the relation of women to men in Sparta. We do learn a lot about Athenian politics. We probably know more about what went on in the ancient world from him than practically anyone else.
There are only two versions of how Athens became democracy. And one of them is Herodotus's. And the second one is Aristotle, and he was clearly taking some stuff from Herodotus. So that it's that vital. It's just a page and a half of what we consider a turning point in history in a way. And that's all we've got to go on. Once you've read that, you know as much as most of the experts.
A review in The New Yorker suggested that Herodotus had fallen in the estimation of historians and classicists over the years and is now experiencing a revival. Is that your sense?
Yes.
And why? Because people are starting to respect him again?
Yeah. I think people, for a long time, there was a sort of a Germanic push for scientific history. And Thucydides mirrors that much better. By limiting history to politics and war, he fed that in a way. And so Herodotus was considered folk tales and fantasies. But in fact, now we don't think that. We think Herodotus' conception of history is very, very good and broad.
Now, I have very little time, but you did not study classics in college.
No, I didn't.
And you have wound up one of the more important classicists.
I ended up teaching at a little school in western Massachusetts called Simon's Rock. I was teaching Greek literature in translation. I'm not competent to teach it in anything else. And I found that my students needed the help of a good edition, and that's what spurred me on to do these.
And Robert B. Strassel's latest edition is the landmark Herodotus, The Histories, with the new translation by Andrea L. Purvis, published by Pantheon. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.